It's 1 Chronicles 27, not 37. 1 Chronicles 27, verse 2. And if you take a look at verse 32 in that same chapter, you will see a man called Hachmonai. Hachmonai. Okay? So, his name is Jehoshabim, and his clan, he's of the clan Hachmonite. In other words, his daddy, granddaddy, great-granddaddy, someone was Hachmonai. Okay? Good. We took care of that problem. Notice both of them tell us on the second line that he was chief of the captains, so we know we're talking about the same guy. Now, what about on the other side? You say, well, Floyd, Tachmonite, Hachmonite, yeah, it's close. You know, who cares whether it's a T or an H? Now, in Hebrew, they don't mean anywhere near the same thing. They have nothing to do with each other. Now, let me set you up for it. Notice it says the Tachmonite, and on the other side it says an Hachmonite. How many of you know the difference between the word the and an? See, the is the definite article. Big difference. What if I tell you I am the teacher? You know, it's one thing if I say, hi, hon, I'm a Bible teacher. But what if I come in and say, I am the Bible teacher? There's a big difference. You know, what if I come in, yeah, and I'll tell you, I did this in college. You'll love it. When I transferred colleges and took my first course in geology, I answered a question. I gave an answer that the teacher had no idea anyone knew. And he asked me my name, and I said, Jones. He said, what's your first name? Floyd. Well, later that day, I got another chance to distinguish myself, and he began to call me the Jones. And I began to sign my homework and test papers, just plain the. Oh, y'all, see, you don't know arrogance. You guys just think you had pride. I had pride. Hey, it goes beyond pride. Arrogant. All right? Well, the point I'm driving at, of course, is I understand the difference between the and. See, if I tell you I am the Jones as opposed to telling you, honey, I am a Jones. Woo! See, that's a huge difference. All right. The Tachmonite. The word Tachmonite means wise. All right, now, let me tell you what this means, the ideas. It's one thing to be a great warrior. Listen to me, there are a lot of men that are great warriors who are not great leaders. They don't know much about the military. You don't want to follow these guys into battle. You want them with you going into battle, but you don't want them to make the decisions. The idea here is he was not only the greatest warrior beside David. By the way, David, I'll just let the cat out of the bag. David was a greater warrior than any of these men. This is his hall of fame. He doesn't throw himself in it. Okay? In other words, God had already dealt with him about his pride, so that he didn't throw his name. Now, back when I was lost, see, my name would have been in here. It was my ring of honor. I would have been first chair. Mm-hmm. But see, it means he's right. So he's a military genius. That's what I'm getting at. He is not only a great warrior, he is a military genius. Listen, Audie Murphy, the greatest warrior we had that survived to tell about it in World War II. Listen, there may have been greater warriors, but they were killed. You know, didn't get a chance to write the story. Didn't live long enough to achieve. See, a lot of the great warriors aren't necessarily great commanders. World War I, Alvin C. York of Tennessee. Alvin was a pacifist. He got saved before he went in the military, and he didn't want to kill anybody. But he got placed in a situation where German machine gun fire was coming down on his small little group of men in three directions. And he realized that someone was going to die. There was nothing he could do to avoid that someone was going to die. And it looked like it was going to be his friends. And he saw that the only way he could save his friends was for him to kill Germans. He didn't like his choices. Now, I got stuck in a situation like that one time. I remember in Denver. Surely you'll remember this. We were visiting a wealthy family. They had a home out at Evergreen, about 100 acres, a stream going through the land. Their home was up on a small mountain. And by the way, Willie Nelson ended up buying that from them. Oh, he and my friend that I'd led to the Lord was a Jew. And he made a killing on Willie. And the government took the place away from Willie. You know how that went. But at any rate, it was called Alasta Ranch. Alasta, okay? And they had this stream going. And they had brought in geese and ducks, paid a lot of money, you know, bought them and brought in. And there were two dogs. They had a leash law, but two dogs were out, and they were into a bloodlust. Once an animal gets in, you can't call them off. They hear nothing, they see nothing, they're just going to kill. Well, I was in the house reading when the girl that we were staying with, the wife, came in, went to the gun rack, and took out a rifle. And I said, "What's going on?" And she tells me, "There's two dogs that are going to kill our geese and ducks." So I walk out on the porch, out on the balcony with her, and Shirley was there. And as we're looking down, we're looking at about 200 yards, and we're shooting down toward water. And I can look about a half mile straight on out is a subdivision. And I said, "Do you intend to shoot?" And she said, "Yes." Now listen to me, I love dogs. But I had to make a decision real fast. Something was about to die. If she missed, she could ricochet off that water and kill somebody a half mile away with that rifle. I was an expert rifleman in the Marines, and I knew I wouldn't miss. I said, "Well, if you're going to shoot, then let me shoot." All I could see was the back of the dog's head swimming toward... The older dog was in the water chasing them. They were in the water trying to get away, and he was chasing them right toward the younger dog that was waiting and took him out. I hated it. Bothered me for weeks. The point is, there are times in your life you can get thrown into a situation where you don't like any choice. Something was going to die. I'd rather it have been the dog than possibly somebody if she missed. All right. So, the same thing we have in our story here. Okay? Hard choices. Choices we don't want to make. Well, did he kill 800 or 300? Both! So, number one, is he a Hochmanite or a Tochmanite? He's both. He is an Hochmanite. He is the Tochmanite. In other words, they have given him a name. Okay? But then it goes on. Look, at the left side, the same was called. I put called in there, okay, in parentheses. It's not in Scripture. It's an added word to make it read smoothly. Adino, the Esnite. Now, that is a play on words in Hebrew. Because the two words almost mean exactly the same thing. They basically mean spear. Adino means spear, and Esnite is just... These are words that don't just have one narrow meaning. And the best I can do with Adino the Esnite to bring it into East Texas, okay? The spearman's spearman. Spira of the spearman. You know, listen. In athletics, we do this, Gary. We do this, right? Babe Ruth was what? The Sultan of SWAT. Remember? Ted Williams. I'm going way back, but some of you older people. The Splendid Splinter. There was a basketball player that was called Earl the Pearl Monroe. Okay? Right. We live in a culture that is accustomed to having heroes that we give appellatives to. We give them nicknames. We give them names of honor that aren't their real name. And we all know exactly who we're talking about when we say the name. So they gave him, he was dubbed this as an honor. In other words, calling him the Tochmanite wasn't enough. He was not only wise, he was the spearman's spearer. Okay? Or I could say the spearman of the spearman. In other words, look, there's guys that use spears, but you don't want to mess with this guy if he's got a spear. He is the greatest spearman we've ever seen. And that's That's why you've got all this. And what it does, instead of us, like we're doing right now, instead of us enjoying finding out about this great man, okay, the scholarly academic culture in theology is just dumbfounded, and if you were reading the commentaries, you'd lose your faith. All right? You said, well, did he kill 800 or 300? He killed 800. When he killed 800, that's how he got the nickname, the Spearman's Spearer, okay, or whatever it was, something like that, Jacob. Okay? Now, remember, Bill, what I taught y'all at the beginning. Chronicles was written 500 years later. So after he won his spurs and got the Congressional Medal of Honor and is in the ring of honor, in another encounter, he killed 300. David is writing 2 Samuel 23 after David dies. This guy does another great feat. He lifted up a spear against 300, slain by him at one time. Okay? And you might notice I put a little footnote over there to the right that he was a descendant of the tribe of Judah. Okay? He was a descendant of Judah through one of Judah's sons, Perez. Okay? We got it. Good. Now, this brings us to 1 Chronicles 11, 12. After him was Eleazar, the son of Dodo the Ahoite, who was one of the three mighties. Now, this gives us some new information. Joab is commander-in-chief. Jehoshabeam has just been named next. And now we see that there's a group of three that's greater than the rest. See this? It says he was one of the three mighties. All right? Now, I'm just going to tell you something quickly. Most of the commentaries put verses 13 and 14 down with Shema instead of with Eleazar. But that's not where it goes. And again, Jason, you'll be able to tell. Again, listen to me. It's a matter, Cal, of just simply reading and paying attention to what you're saying. Look over to the left at 2 Samuel 23:9. It says, after him, Jehoshabeam, was Eleazar, the son of Dodo the Ahoite. Notice when you read across the two lines, we've got it lined up. One of the three mighty men. Look at what's next. With David. Ooh, look across to the right side at 1 Chronicles 11:13. He was with David. Now, when you read down at, when we come to Shema, you'll notice there's no mention of David being there at that battle. See, I'm trying to show you, Betty, how you can tell this is the way to line it up. This great warrior, whoever it is with David. Well, it just told us that Eleazar was with him. Now, we see that 1 Chronicles tells us where? At Pasdamin. And no, we do not know exactly where Pasdamin is today. Archaeologically, Your Honor, we haven't found it yet. Okay, look what's next. Over at the left-hand side, they defied the Philistines. Again, notice it's David and Eleazar, two men. They defied the Philistines that were gathered together to battle. Notice on the right-hand side, it says, where there was a parcel of ground full of barley. Whoa, why is that important? Let me tell you why it's important. Because that tells us for sure it's not dealing with Shema. How so, Brother Floyd? When we read Shema, you will see that there he fought in a field of lentils. Lentils, that's not barley. Barley is kind of like wheat, okay? More like wheat. Lentils, that's kind of like pinto beans, okay? These are beans. And it tells us something else. The barley season is March and April in Israel. Lentil season is June and July. It can't be that you line them up the way. And I can assure you, if you go home, if you have any commentaries, I can assure you, if you look it up, let's just say you have 10. Nine of them are going to miss it. Nine of them are going to miss it. And I'm trying to show you, look, have you noticed that what I've just told you there doesn't take 180 IQ? Did you hear it? You know, all you got to do, is look up in a Bible dictionary, and it'll tell you when the seasons are. If you go to the calendar, the monthly calendar, it'll tell you when the various crops come up. And also, just looking at the pronoun, he was with David. Okay? So there was a parcel of ground full of barley. Says the people fled from before the Philistines, and they set themselves. Look at that. Now, over on the other side, it just talks about Eleazar setting himself. He arose, but it's already said he was with David and that there was a they prior to that. In other words, David is writing 2 Samuel, and he's not boasting on himself. He wants us to get how great Eleazar is. But Chronicles is written afterwards, and they want you to understand David was great. Have you got that? So that, it says, they set themselves in the midst of that parcel and delivered it and slew the Philistines. Now look over to the Samuel side. It says, Eleazar smote the Philistines till his hand was weary. His hand clave to the sword. And the Lord wrought a great victory that day. Don't you love it? After telling us how great Eleazar and David fought, the truth came out. God gave the victory. And I want to tell you why. Let me tell you several things here. Listen to me, beloved. Did you get it? He's fighting so hard, he can't let go the sword. You got to pry his hand off it. Listen to me. When you're in battles like this, you're not thinking. There's no time to think. You're fighting for your life. You're outnumbered so horribly, you're chopping as fast as you can chop. Basically, his hand is almost cramped in this position. They had to pry him loose. And David says, now there's one of my top warriors. Okay? Now. What was God's resource in this story? I'm so excited about it. He had two brave men. That was his resource. There was a whole jolly army of Philistines. And he had two brave men who put their lives in God's hands. And the result, and see, God tells us the truth. God delivered them. Now, they did their best. Listen to me. Beloved, these stories I'm reading to you, where Jehoshaphat killed 800 men in a single battle with a spear, and another time 300. Let me just tell you this. Make sure you understand. This cannot be done in normal human strength. It really can't. That's why God says He wrought the victory. Okay? I was runner-up in the state Golden Gloves once upon a time, 1742. Okay? And I noticed my first cousin, who was 5 years older than I, was Mid-South Bantamweight champion. And so I went to many fights. My family was into this. And so I noticed that most amateurs lost because they got arm weary. You'd see these muscled up kids come out, and they weren't boxers. They were throwing haymakers. And they'd try and kill you in the first round. And by the middle of the second round, most of them couldn't lift their arms. So I realized that the secret to winning was not only to learn how to box and throw a left jab and learn how to throw combinations and how to move your head. Most amateurs, listen to me, most amateurs never move their head. You don't even have to look. All you got to have any idea. See, their head is going to be straight above their navel. Duh. See, look, watch this. If you don't move your head, your chin is straight over the navel. So you can be looking at his stomach and you know where the chin is. See? You don't even have to look because they don't move it. Very few amateur, just watch the Golden Gloves, you'll see it. And so it was easy to knock them out. You knew where it was. Right? So I determined I was not going to get arm weary. Now, in Golden Glove fighting, you have 1 minute to rest between rounds, and you fight 2 minute rounds, and you only fight 3 rounds. You say, good grief, 6 minutes is all? You can't believe how tired you can get. You cannot. The first thing that happens to you is sheer terror hits you. First time I stepped out of the dressing room, all the lights were off in this auditorium with about 10,000 people, and there was one light right over the middle of the ring, and the other guy was already in the ring. And for the first time, it occurred to me, he had only come for one reason: to beat me senseless. Up until that moment, I wasn't afraid. But when I realized, and on the way down the aisle, I got madder and madder. I started thinking, he has come to humiliate me in front of 10,000 people. He has come to try and make a fool of me in front of... By the time I got in the ring, I was blind with rage. Kill. Now, see these blue eyes? They are beautiful, aren't they? See these soft blue eyes? See, until that night, the way I thought about myself was, you know, if I ever saw anyone really helpless, I would feel compassion for them. When I hit him the first straight solid shot that stunned him defenseless, just suddenly it came over me. He has tried to hurt me and he is never going to get to swing again. I tried to hold him up so that I could hit him one more time. Don't go down, don't go down, you know, because he might get up. See, in other words, fear was in it too. I feared he might get up and hit me as hard as I was hitting him. And I learned something about myself that night. I was not a nice person. I had these beautiful soft blue eyes, but in my heart, I liked hitting people. Jesus had his hands full when he got hold of Brother Floyd. And so every night going into the fights to try and offset arm weariness, after I'd already worked out, just before I went to bed, I would get soup cans. And instead of a 2-minute round, I would make my arms go in circles fully extended for 3 minutes, an extra minute. And then I would reverse them. And then I would squeeze the can. And instead of resting for 1 minute, I would rest for 30 seconds. And I would do that for 6 rounds. It took me a while to build up to that. Let me tell you, you ought to try hitting the heavy bag. I never forget my coach, who was Navy champion, brings me in and introduces me to combinations. We walk through combinations. He said, left, left, right, left, right. You know, always end up with a left so that you're back on the right side, you know. And so we walk through it, and I said, there's nothing to these combinations. He says, try it on that heavy bag. Let me tell you what, not one person in this room can do except maybe you. You can't hit a heavy bag for 2 minutes. You can't sit there and throw punches on a big bag for 2 minutes. It would take you weeks and weeks to have a chance to do it. 3 minutes, you're going to have trouble with 3 minutes. And let me tell you, that young man right there is a SWAT, ex-SWAT man, and he is, his muscles have muscles. Okay? He is really first-class physical condition. And so, what I'm getting at is, I've been around athletes, I've done this kind of stuff in, and I'm telling you, in 2-3 minutes, you're exhausted. You don't kill 800 and 300 or 300 men in 2 or 3 minutes. This is going on. God is literally, these men may be strong, they may be great athletes, they're great warriors, but I'm telling you, it takes more than that. God's got his little hand in all this. Are you with me? Good, you're with me. Now, so, oh, don't you love it? Can't you see it? Two guys out in a barley field and a whole jolly army of Philistines moving in on them. Picture Las Vegas. The odds makers placing bets on the outcome. Think of the odds you could have gotten on this battle. But as the scripture says, the Lord wrought a great victory. And then it says, and the people returned after him only to the spoil. Wow. See, I'm frustrated. God frustrates me. See, he doesn't tell us how many Philistines were there when Eleazar and David stood back to back. Listen, the fact that God had his hand on, God may have his hand on, but I don't read in this story where God said, don't worry about a thing, Eleazar. I'm not going to let you die. No, this dog doesn't know that. He is in there. Now, the next one amazes me even more. It's on the left-hand side, 2 Samuel 23:11. After him, in other words, after Eleazar, was Shema the son of Agi, the Hararite, and the Philistines were gathered together into a troop, where was a piece of ground full of lentils, and the people fled from the Philistines. But, don't you just love conjunctions? The people fled. Do you see what's happening? See, the Philistine, notice it's springtime, summertime, First of summer, spring. The Philistines knew the scenario. Look up at the map on the board. Here's Philistia. They knew the land. They knew when the Hebrews, when the Jews harvested their crops. And there's nothing worse than an egg-sucking dog. The old country boys laughed on that one. Bill, you liked that one, didn't you? In other words, the Philistines aren't doing any work. They're not farming the land. They're letting the Jews farm it, and then they go raid it and steal the crops. And the picture I get is, I'm using my imagination now, but I can just see Shema, an old raw-bone country boy. And he figures that we planted the crop and ain't no Philistine getting it. A-I-N. Ain't no Philistine getting it. Everyone else runs. Hey, but one man says, no way. I'll die first. I worked hard on that land. We sweated for this and I'm not running. I love it. Whether it happened that way or not. The Philistines were gathered together in a troop where there was a piece of ground full of lentils. I'm going to tell you something. If you don't understand a man being willing to die over a group of lentils, you know, beans, kind of like red beans almost, pinto beans. And the people fled from the Philistines. They fled. But he stood in the midst of the ground and defended it and slew the Philistines, and the Lord wrought a great victory. Has anyone seen it besides me? You understand what we're talking about tonight? We're talking about the word commitment. We're talking about faith. We're talking about trusting God. We're talking about how much difference can one man make. Do you understand? Do you see what I'm getting at? It really only takes one person committed. Go to the second page. Because that wasn't the lesson. Now, if you look at the last half of that page, you'll see some names. Abishai and Benaiah. I'm going to put them up here. If you read, reading this first one on Abishai, which isn't the lesson either, on the Chronicle side, it says Abishai was the brother of Joab. He was chief of the three, for he lifted up his spear against 300. He slew them and had a name among the three, and of the three he was more honorable than the two. He was their captain, but he attained not to the first three. Oh! Let's look at that. It says, now there was Abishai, and he killed 300 men in a single battle. And he was of three, and he was more honorable than the two in the three, but he did not attain to the first three. The first three, in other words, we're seeing that they're divided into ranks. There is Joab is over the whole thing, and then here, Joshabim, Eleazar, and Shema, that's the first rank, or the first class, of the great heroes. The second class, and there's three of them, the second class of them is another three, of which Abishai was one of the three. He was the captain of those three, but he was greater than the other two, but did not attain to the first three. Even though he killed as many men, there were other things involved in being the general and commander of the army. And the next one is Benaiah. Now, when we read about him, I'll tell you, he was a doozer. Look at the right-hand side, 1 Chronicles 11. Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada. Now, if you look at 1 Chronicles 27:5, it says Jehoiada. This Jehoiada was a priest. So, hey, we've got his tribe down. He's from the tribe of Levi. He's from the family of Aaron. This guy should have been a priest. I don't know what's going on here. I'm just telling you that's his lineage. But that isn't it. He said, and Jehoiada was a... He said he was the son of a valiant man of Kabzeel. Now remember, in these battles, priests fought too. A lot of times. I can show you. The Levites were some of the best warriors. The Levites guarded the temple. You fool with that temple, you had Levites fighting you right and left.